All right, get ready to dive deep, everybody. Today we're tackling the world of counseling, and we've got a treasure trove of insights to unearth from the study guide and those videos. Believe me, this is way more interesting than just textbook stuff.
It really is. And we're going to equip you to think critically about all the different approaches to counseling.
You know, something really struck me in one of the videos we're working with. They talked about how different cultures see time totally differently. They even called it, get this, CP time. Which really made me think about how crucial cultural sensitivity is in counseling. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, it's absolutely essential. Think about it this way. For years, people talked about cultural integration as this big melting pot, right?
Yeah, blend together, become one thing. I've heard that before.
Right, but these days, it's more like a salad bowl. You know, each ingredient brings its own unique flavor. In counseling, that means respecting each person's individual background and how that shapes their worldview. And it affects everything, from how they communicate to how they view mental health itself.
That salad bowl thing, it just makes so much sense. But how does a counselor actually put that into practice? It's like there are all these unspoken rules, right?
Exactly. And that's where this idea of broaching comes in. It's about a counselor gently acknowledging those differences. Like, say you have a client who avoids eye contact. Instead of jumping to conclusions, maybe you could say something like, "I've noticed that sometimes you look away when we talk. In some cultures, that's a sign of respect, but I just want to make sure you're comfortable with me."
It's like those awkward elevator moments, you know, trying to figure out which way to face. Total cultural minefield. I bet those kinds of differences can really impact how therapy goes.
You hit the nail on the head. There are studies that show a large percentage of African American men, for example, they don't actually come back after the first therapy session.
Really?
Yeah, there's a real lack of trust in the system, and you can't ignore those historical and societal factors.
That's a powerful point. Makes you realize just how much history still plays a role. It's like we, as counselors, we can't ignore those power dynamics at play.
Exactly. And it goes beyond historical trauma, too. Even something like how people communicate can be really different. Silence in therapy, for instance.
Oh,
It doesn't
interesting.
always mean the same thing across cultures.
You know, I probably would have assumed silence was a sign of resistance or something.
Right. But it could actually be a sign of respect, a way of processing thoughts. It could even be that interrupting is frowned upon in their culture.
Yeah.
You have to pay attention to all the nuances of how people express themselves. Even family dynamics, which are central to therapy, those are influenced by culture too. Like, take multi-generational households.
Right, which are more common in some Asian cultures, right?
Exactly. It might mean that therapy needs to involve more than just the individual client.
That makes you wonder how much of our behavior is nature versus nurture, you know?
Yeah.
What's hardwired and what's shaped by our upbringing and surroundings?
$1 million question, right? And honestly, we could spend hours unpacking it. But for the sake of our deep dive here, let's shift gears a bit. Let's look at another essential piece of being a counselor, which is navigating the ethical landscape.
Yes, ethics. That's where things get really interesting. And I'm really curious about this whole confidentiality thing. Seems simple enough on the surface, but I have a feeling it's more complicated than it seems.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Confidentiality, it's the foundation of the counselor-client relationship, but there are some exceptions. One of the big ones is something called duty to warn.
Duty to warn. Okay, now you have to explain that one. When does a counselor actually have to break confidentiality?
Well, if a client is a serious, imminent threat to themselves or to other people, a counselor has a legal obligation to act to protect the potential victim.
Wow, that's a heavy responsibility.
It is. It could mean having to call the authorities, warning the person at risk, even hospitalizing the client. If it comes to that, it's a judgment call, no doubt. But the safety of everyone involved has to be the top priority.
Absolutely. Talk about walking an ethical tightrope.
Yeah, for sure. And while we're on the topic of ethical dilemmas, gift giving is another one that can be tricky.
I bet. So is there like a rule book for what's okay and what isn't?
Not really. There aren't hard and fast rules about how much a gift can cost or anything like that. You have to think about the client's background, the potential for exploitation. It always comes down to using good judgment and making the client's well-being your top priority.
Sounds like cultural sensitivity is crucial when you're dealing with these ethical situations.
100%. And that actually brings us to another aspect of confidentiality that I think is worth mentioning: schools.
Oh, right, because once you're dealing with schools, you've got FERPA to consider. And for anyone who doesn't know, FERPA is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, right? It protects student records. But how does that work with, say, counseling records? Do parents automatically get to see those?
See, that's where it gets interesting. It can depend on the state and how the school interprets FERPA. Sometimes, yeah, parents have the right to access those records. But there are exceptions, especially if releasing the information could put the student in danger.
So it's not as clear-cut as you might think. Counselors really need to be on top of those legal and ethical complexities.
Absolutely. And these days, those ethical considerations, they extend online as well.
Oh, for sure. Social media throws a whole other wrench into things. Any advice for counselors trying to navigate that world?
The biggest thing is to have separate personal and professional profiles online.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want a potential client or a future employer stumbling across photos from your crazy weekend trip or anything like that.
No, definitely not a good look.
Exactly. It's all about maintaining those professional boundaries, thinking carefully about what you post and how it could be perceived.
Makes sense. You don't want to blur those lines. So we've talked about cultural sensitivity. We've talked about ethics. But what about the actual approaches that counselors use? What about the theories that guide how they work?
Now we're getting to the good stuff.
Yeah.
We're talking about the foundation of counseling. And your materials highlight some of the giants in the field.
All right, let's dive into these theories. I'm ready to hear about the giants of counseling. Who are we starting with?
Well, we can't talk about counseling theories without mentioning Freud. He's like the grandfather of it all.
Freud, right. All those theories about the unconscious mind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sigmund Freud. Might be a bit controversial, but his ideas really change how we see the mind. One of his most famous ideas is the psychosexual stages of development.
Oh, yeah. Those stages. Oral, anal, phallic. I could never keep them straight.
Well, get ready to ace your next psych test.
Yeah.
Because your study guide has this great mnemonic to help remember them. Orphan, Annie, pretty little girl.
Okay.
Each word stands for a stage. Oral, anal, phallic, latency, genital.
Orphan, Annie, pretty little girl. That's actually really good. I'm not going to lie. I'm going to remember that. Okay. So Freud was all about the unconscious. But what about how our thinking develops as we grow up?
Ah, you're talking about Jean Piaget. He was the man when it came to understanding how kids learn and think.
Piaget, yeah. What was so groundbreaking about his work?
Well, he showed that kids don't just think like little adults. They go through these totally unique stages. Like, one of his key concepts is something called conservation. It's this understanding that something stays the same, even if it looks different.
Okay, so like if you pour juice from a short, wide glass into a tall, skinny one, a kid who hasn't gotten conservation yet would think there's more juice in the tall glass.
You got it. And Piaget, he actually showed how kids develop that ability to understand these more abstract ideas.
It really makes you appreciate how much our view of the world changes as we grow.
It really does. And speaking of growth, let's talk about Erik Erikson and his psychosocial stages.
Oh, yeah, Erikson. He's the one who said we go through these big crises all throughout our lives, right?
He did. Erikson, he kind of built upon Freud's ideas, but he focused more on the social and cultural stuff.
Yeah.
He had these eight stages from birth to old age, and each one has a psychological challenge that we need to work through.
Didn't he have one called, like, generativity versus stagnation? Something like that.
That's the one for midlife. It's all about finding meaning, you know, contributing to the next generation, leaving a mark on the world.
I can see why that one's so relevant today. A lot of people feel like they're just stuck in a rut, especially in midlife.
Exactly. That feeling of stagnation can be a real struggle. It highlights how important it is to find ways to give back, to make a difference.
So we've got Freud, Piaget, Erikson. Those are some big names in psychology. What about some of the newer approaches to therapy?
Well, your materials mention reality therapy, which was developed by a guy named William Glasser.
Reality therapy. Okay, I'm intrigued. What's the basic idea there?
So reality therapy is all about empowering people to take control of their own lives. Glasser believed we're not just products of our pasts. We have the power to choose how we behave, create the reality we want.
So instead of dwelling on what you can't change, you focus on figuring out what you need and making choices that support those needs.
Exactly. It's about focusing on what you can control, not on what you can't.
That's very practical. I like it. What other approaches are out there?
Let's see. Your sources also talk about Gestalt therapy, which was developed by Fritz Perls. It's all about the here and now, really focusing on being present and self-aware.
Gestalt therapy, isn't that the one with the empty chair technique?
That's the one. It's a powerful way to deal with unresolved issues, conflicts, emotions. You picture someone you need to work things out with, sitting in that empty chair.
Wow. That sounds intense, but I can see how it could be really helpful. So what about Carl Rogers? He's a big name in therapy too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Carl Rogers kind of revolutionized things with something called person-centered therapy. His whole thing was that the relationship between the counselor and the client, that's the most important thing. He wanted to create this safe space, totally judgment-free, where people could explore their feelings and come up with their own answers.
I love that idea. So it's not about the therapist having all the answers, but about empowering the client to find their own way.
Exactly. Rogers, he talked about empathy, being genuine, and unconditional positive regard as like the key ingredients to a good therapeutic relationship.
Okay, so we've got Freud, Piaget, Erickson, Glasser, Pearls, and Rogers. Wow, that is a lot of theories. How does a counselor even choose which one to use with a particular client?
That's where assessment comes in. And it's a really important part of the process. It's all about understanding the client's specific needs, their challenges.
Assessment. Okay, so tell me more about that. What does that actually look like?
Well, it involves gathering information from a bunch of different sources, like standardized tests.
Clinical interviews, observations. It's like piecing together a puzzle, right?
Exactly. You're gathering all these different pieces of information to get a complete picture of the client's situation, their strengths, their challenges.
So it's kind of like detective work in a way.
That's a great way to put it. You're gathering clues to figure out the client's story and what approaches might be most effective.
And speaking of clues, what about diagnoses? How does a counselor actually figure out if someone has a specific mental health condition?
Well, here in the U.S., the go-to is the DSM-5. That stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's basically like the encyclopedia of mental health.
The DSM, yeah, I've heard of that. It lists out all the criteria for different disorders, right?
Exactly. And it's always being updated as we learn more and more about mental health. For example, it wasn't that long ago that PTSD was officially recognized as its own diagnosis.
Wow, I had no idea. So the DSM helps counselors speak the same language, but it's also evolving all the time, right? As our understanding grows.
Precisely. It's a dynamic tool. And there's always discussion about how to best categorize and diagnose these conditions.
Makes sense. Can you give me a few examples of how the DSM is used to diagnose specific things?
Sure. Let's take bipolar disorder. The DSM, it distinguishes between bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, based on how severe the manic episodes are and how long they last.
Okay, so break that down for me. What's the difference between mania and hypomania?
Good question. So mania, that's marked by a period of really intense, elevated mood, often with tons of energy, racing thoughts, impulsivity, sometimes even psychotic symptoms. Hypomania is similar, but the symptoms aren't as intense and they don't stick around as long.
Got it. So bipolar 1 is those full-blown manic episodes, and bipolar 2 is the hypomania, the less severe form.
You got it. Now let's look at another common diagnosis, PTSD.
PTSD, that's not just for combat veterans though, right?
Right, that's a misconception. PTSD can happen after any kind of traumatic event, like a car accident, natural disaster, witnessing violence. The key thing is the event causes this lasting response of fear, helplessness, horror, something like that.
So it's about how a person processes and copes with the trauma, not just the event itself.
Exactly. The DSM, it lists specific symptoms of PTSD. Things like intrusive memories, flashbacks, nightmares, avoiding reminders of the trauma, negative thoughts, changes in how you react to things.
It sounds incredibly complex, and like it can have a really long-lasting impact.
It can. And it's so important to remember that everyone experiences and copes with trauma differently. There's no one-size-fits-all approach.
Absolutely. One last one I'm curious about is antisocial personality disorder. What does that even mean? It sounds like someone who just doesn't like being around other people.
That's a common misunderstanding. Antisocial here doesn't mean someone's shy or withdrawn. It's more about this pattern of disregarding social norms, other people's rights, things like that.
So it's not just being introverted. It's more about a lack of empathy and not caring about rules.
Exactly. People with antisocial personality disorder, they might lie, manipulate, act impulsively, be irritable or aggressive, and they often don't feel bad about their actions.
Wow, that sounds incredibly challenging, both for the person with the disorder and the people around them.
It can be. It's complex. Treatment often involves therapy, medication, and support, not just for the individual, but their loved ones as well.
This deep dive has been fascinating, really eye-opening. I feel like I have a whole new appreciation for what counseling really involves, you know, from cultural awareness to ethics to all these different theories and the challenges of diagnosis.
I'm so glad to hear that. It's a field that's constantly growing and changing as we learn more about the human mind.
We've only scratched the surface today, but you've given everyone listening a fantastic starting point to understanding the world of counseling.
And remember, this is just the beginning. Keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep an open mind. Those are the most important things.
Couldn't agree more. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of counseling. We'll see you next time.